Cape Talk.
Health and wellness.
8 minutes past 2 o'clock, and wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I urge you to stop and listen, because Gerda Saunders' story and her words about documenting her own dementia is something that could happen to any of us. This is the story of her journey to remember life before it's too late. Since Gerda Saunders published her memoir, Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia, she's been featured in the New York Times, on major radio and television networks in America. But she was raised on a farm in South Africa, and she immigrated to the US with her husband, Peter, and their two small children in the 1980s. But just before her 61st birthday, she was diagnosed with cerebral microvascular disease. It's a condition that stops blood reaching her brain, and it's the second leading cause of dementia after Alzheimer's. So within months, she decided to retire from her position as the Associate Director of Gender Studies at the University of Utah. Gerda does hold a PhD in English, and she began writing. And one of the first titles of her book was actually Telling Who I Am Before I Forget. She started jotting down notes about daily misadventures, about washing her hair twice in an hour, about leaving pots on the stove to boil dry. And she continues to allow others into her world through her website, GerdaSaunders.com, which features an incredibly moving documentary series. This is her first South African interview. Gerda, it is so wonderful to talk to you this afternoon.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure for me to speak with you, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Memory's Last Breath, it's beautiful. It started as a journal. How?
When I retired, the Faculty of Gender Studies gave me this beautiful leather-bound journal, and I've never really kept a journal. I come from a large family, and I remember having a diary as a child, but I took more time to punch a hole through it and put a lock in it to prevent anyone else from seeing it. So I never after that wrote a journal. But this I thought of more as observations. I actually called my observations field notes, sort of a wink and a joking reference to my background in the sciences.
By the time diagnosis was made, there were warning signs, weren't there? By this time, where you got the journal?
Yes. I had warning signs both at my work and at home. And at my work, there was a particular day when I was actually the chair of a meeting for our Women's Week that year. And I was in the meeting, and I prepared a very specific agenda. And then at some point in the meeting, I just got my thoughts just went away. And when I came back, I could not figure out where I was in the meeting. And so I just looked at my agenda, and I suggested everybody introduce themselves. And then as I was saying it, I realized that people had already introduced themselves. And so it was an awful moment for me, and everybody noticed, because I know they noticed, because they were very kind and said, oh, we all have too much on our plates, we forget. But with other things that happened as well, that was one of the early signs for me that there was something seriously wrong.
And you write in the book, in my heart I already knew I am dementing. You write it as a verb. What was that for you?
Yes. Yes, it was one of those moments that's shocking but funny at the same time, when my neurologist, who was a very matter-of-fact person, said to me, it seems you are already dementing. I just thought that I'd never thought of the word dement as something that one does. I've never thought it in terms of a verb. You know, I'm writing, I'm thinking, I'm eating, I'm dementing. And all the other verbs were much more, I was much more complicit in them. It mean, you know, I decide, okay, I'm going to write, and I'm going to think. You know, I remember Einstein's little quip, I will now a little think. And so it seems to me it was putting some responsibility for dementing on myself. And it brought it to me in a new way that it is actually, this is what I am now living, and I wanted to react to it in that way.
Because you've given your dementia a name as well, haven't you?
I did. It actually started one day when, actually in my book, I gave it a name a long time ago. I was reading about Don Quixote, sort of our example of like stark staring madness. And I was reading actually the book, the Don Quixote. I didn't read the whole book, but I reread some chapters. And it just seemed to me like it felt like he was such a metaphor for what I was feeling, this feeling of just in this landscape and all these strange things popping out where familiar things used to be. And so I called myself Doña Quixote, the female form of that. And then Peter came home one day and he bought at a secondhand store that we have here, he bought a skeleton, and it's about the size of a 3-year-old child. And the minute I saw her, I said, this is Doña Quixote. So the skeleton is like a manifestation of my dementia, that's a solid object. And I dress her in the kind of clothes I like, or that I think I'd like if I, you know, were less in contact with my reason. And it's just a way, the name and the Doña Quixote skeleton are ways of putting my dementia outside of myself so that I can look at it and say, I have dementia, but I am not yet it. There it is, and I can still address it with the reason that I still have.
Were you surprised when you actually sat down to write that you could still find the words?
Yes. I can't say so. In my last year of working, which was after my diagnosis, I had a huge writing project in the university, and I managed to do that, but it cost me dearly. I could not. It was a research project, and I would write on one screen, and then I'd switch screens to go to the research documents. And by the time I got back to the writing screen, I had totally forgotten, you know, what it was that I'd found and also what it was that I needed it for. So I developed a system of writing little handwritten notes for myself about, you know, what it is that I'm looking for. And then I would look for it, and then I'd write just a little summary of what it is that I found. So in that way, I was able to complete the document, but it took so long and it exhausted me totally. So that is some of what I had to do when I wrote the book. But I want to really speak about that in a larger context. And that is that it's characteristic of people with dementia, with some kinds of dementias, people who have ingrained skills, that they retain those skills longer than their ability to remember how to brush their teeth. So musicians keep on being able to play complicated music. Even in my book, I speak about a case where a man was able to still read a complex score and play it with the right intonation and feeling, but he could not take care of himself whatsoever. He had a full-time caretaker for his daily needs. And in my sense, because I have written as part of my work in my life for the past 35 years at least, constantly. And so that is a skill that is so ingrained that I was able to still do it. And then another thing with writing is you can't necessarily remember the words, but because you can come back to it an hour later or 2 hours later, you can eventually find that word. So I think that is, those are some of the reasons that, you know, that it was wonderful for me that I could still write, but it was not easy. And once I started research, it was not surprising. But if I may say one more thing, is that our cultural impression of people with dementia is really people from a very much later stage of dementia. So I was diagnosed relatively early in my dementia, and since I've been diagnosed, I'm astonished at how many people I meet who have some of the very same symptoms that I have, but who are not interested in finding out what the name is for what gives them those symptoms. And I think they keep functioning in this hard way that I described in my work. They used to keep functioning in their jobs at the cost of great exhaustion and taking their focus away from things like family and friends. Mm.
You talk a lot about family and friends, and a huge support for you is Peter. You've been married for almost 50 years. In what ways has your condition changed your relationship?
I think our relationship was characterized from the beginning as one of great independence from each other. We each had our own realm of activity, and in the beginning, first I had my own job, then I was a full-time mother, and then later on I got back into my career. But we spend very close times together, you know, very regularly. I think we are still one of the families, especially in the United States, people don't have their meals together anymore at all. And we still have just about three meals together and have over all the years, except if one of us were on a business trip. So when we're at home, we have a very close relationship, but we were able to let each other go places or travel. And I think that is completely changed because I really feel that I'm attached to his hip, and that I think that is a burden for him, which he bears with incredible grace and love and kindness. But it makes me think that he must feel about me like I felt about my two toddlers, you know, under 4 years old, that they are just always there and they just always need me. And so we still try to arrange things where I can do something by myself. For example, I can still walk freely in a shopping mall. I can't just in an open space because I get lost. But so I take Uber to the mall, and then he has an afternoon where he doesn't have to help me with things all the time. But in the meantime, I also think this made me more dependent on him, but I think it's also a kind of humbling of me as a former rampant feminist to admit that I need help and that I need his help. And in a way, that has brought us closer. I feel that we're very close, but also with a sad prospect that this cannot continue, because one of the big battles of dementia on a daily basis is that you struggle to stay in the present. That is a big thing for me. I find myself, you know, in a group like with my children or grandchildren, and I feel I really have to focus hard to stay here on what we're doing or talking about. My head wants to just go somewhere to a quiet place. And so in my book, I wrote about Iris Murdoch, who had dementia, and she became very dependent on her husband, John Bailey. And he described their relationship as the dementia got worse. He described it as we're growing closer and closer apart. And I'm afraid that is what is in store for us too.
One of the hardest documentaries to watch was where you discuss ending your life, and the question, as you put it, is what happens when you cross from being alive to the living death of madness. What was the answer that you and your family found?
In our family, we have always spoken about the quality, the worthwhile quality of life. You know, throughout the years, if someone gets very sick or if someone is close to death, we would speak about it and you know, say, you know, you wonder if that person would not rather just rather want to be dead rather than go through this extended process of dying. And for me, the notion of dying of a physical illness is something I can kind of get my head around because it's maybe some months of pain. But in dementia, it takes years to die for some people. And my mother had dementia, and it felt to me that she was most of the time living a worthwhile quality of life. She had people taking care of her. She had my family. She had my sisters. And she complained all the time about being lonely and being miserable, and especially in her written journals. She just writes of the loneliness. She never expressed to me or to anyone else I know the desire to die. But for me, if I can live with the kind of quality of life my mother had until almost her death, I could do that. If I could still get pleasure from other people, if I could still like hold a baby or hold a grandchild or give someone a hug and be close to them, I value that. But if I come to a state where I am not recognizing anybody, I am scared of them or I scare them, when I just constantly am unhappy, especially when I have no words left and I can't tell people why I'm unhappy. And if I just really become a body that takes in food at the one end and eliminates waste at the other end, for me, that is not a worthwhile quality of life. So my husband and I and our children have decided, I have asked them to give me the great gift of an assisted death when I no longer fulfill those criteria. And they have all agreed, my son Newton, my daughter Marissa, her husband Adam, and my son's wife Cheryl, all of them are in on it and feel that they're going to try their very best to give me this gift. Now, I cannot legally achieve that in the United States the way the laws are at the moment. So it seems that will involve a trip to Europe. I think the last thing anybody wants is to go on a trip in their last days. But if that is the only option we have, that is what my family has undertaken to help me do.
How are you doing now?
The laws yet changed. I'm still doing wonderfully. I still have, I still have, in small things, I feel that I lose my reason. Like in a moment, Peter and I would have a conversation and we would just decide something. And the next minute, I'm back to a different decision because those things in my mind just don't connect. But on a larger scale, I feel I can still understand some overall larger ideas and concepts. But then on a daily basis, it's very exhausting, the struggle to try to stay in touch with the world. Because when I'm just like this and I'm talking just about things that are in my head with one person without interruptions, I can do it. But the minute the external environment interferes, I'm off. I can't make a cup of coffee because my mind goes wherever my eyes are. So if my eyes fall on, you know, look out the window and I see my new plants that I've planted, I will drop everything in the coffee and I'll go and water them first. And then while I'm there, I start pulling weeds and so it goes on all day. So for me to get anything done, it's just an emotionally exhausting process of trying to stay focused. But with Peter's help, he's always kind of like pushing me in the right direction or saying, remember you were doing this or remember you were doing that. I feel at this moment, my life is so worthwhile, and my friends and my family and my grandchildren are just the joy of my life. So I feel that I'm still doing very, very well. And thank you for asking.
Your book isn't yet available in South Africa, but will readers get a chance to meet you?
That is my biggest wish for my book. I wrote the book because I was working through this inner struggle that I had about my identity. So I used to think of myself as this intellectual person and I still relate to the world very much in that way. You know, I want to know the facts and I want to create a reasonable plan and I want to live that way. But then in my private life, I can't execute those things anymore because I'm all over the place. So then the question comes, so who am I now? And for me, those questions have always been something that I would work out in writing. So the book was a selfish project for me to try to figure out, you know, who can I be now that I'm not that person that I always thought of myself of. But then the fact that other people are finding it helpful and interesting is just such a bonus. And to me, this the greatest gift would be if it could be available in South Africa. And my agent, Kate Garrick of the Carpinger Agency, is busy working on the international rights. And I hope that as soon as some contract is closed with somebody who will, either in Europe, someone who will distribute to South Africa, or if there's a South African publisher, who would be interested, that would be the most wonderful gift, because that would mean that I could come and visit and, you know, of course, the big thing, see my family, see my friends, and also maybe read from my book and speak to people about it. So I hope that will happen.
Gerda Saunders, what a pleasure to speak to you. The book is Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. It is available on Amazon. Her website is gerdasaunders.com, and it features that incredibly moving documentary series. You will fall in love with her and her family. It's